It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up on Central Time, we'll get an economist's perspective on Governor Walker's budget.
But first, issues of public and private education in Wisconsin are grabbing a lot of attention in the wake of that budget release announced Tuesday.
Even before the plan was unveiled, some details of the governor's proposal had already emerged, from expanding the school voucher program to loosening up teachers' licensing requirements.
With the complete budget in hand, there's a lot to pore over when it comes to education here in the state. Erin Richards joins us now to give us the lowdown. She's education reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Erin, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Well, before we delve into all the details, there's not one huge big ticket item, but it seems like this really does a lot with education. I think your paper used the headline, would virtually upend the status quo. How so?
Well, there's a lot of changes in here that would be really important policy moves. So beyond just, you know, we think of budget and we think of numbers for schools and agencies, but there's quite a few policy proposals tucked into this budget as well. So, of course, it's a proposal right now, but these, you know, if proposed as enacted, these would mean some pretty sweeping changes for public schools in the state as well as private schools.
Well, let's start with one thing that wasn't in the budget, an increase in public school funding. State Superintendent of Education of Public Instruction, Tony Evers, had asked for a substantial increase. It's not there. He says schools are at a breaking point. What does this mean for schools practically?
Well, the practical effect on schools is that they have generally flat funding. So what the governor did was propose that school aids would increase a little bit, but because he didn't increase this limit on districts and how much they can raise in property taxes and state aid, any increase he puts into sort of the general state aid just flows right through the districts and ends up being a tax break for property taxpayers. So on practical effects, schools don't have extra money to spend in this budget. And on top of that, there was a sort of a little-known provision, or at least most people didn't notice it at first when the budget was introduced on Tuesday. But after that, administrators started noticing that sort of a special aid allotment that they'd gotten in the last 2 years was not renewed in Walker's first year of the budget. That would mean a practical effect of losing $127 million that K-12 schools thought they'd have to spend this year. So if you made your budget for your district under the assumption that you were getting no new money this year, that's one thing. But if now you're looking at your budget and you didn't factor in that you were going to lose a portion of that $127 million, now you've got to go redo your budget again and try to figure out how you're going to plug that hole.
Is there anything else schools have as options on the revenue side? There's the state aid, there's property taxes, which they can't increase. Do they have other options?
It's probably going to amount to figuring out where else to cut in your district. There isn't a lot that that schools can do if they're not allowed to raise more in property taxes and they're not getting the practical effect of more state aid. Those are your two main revenue streams. So the only other way that you can save dollars is to cut people or programs that you have, or figure out ways to be more efficient with the resources that you have.
Some lawmakers have expressed at least some openness to trying to increase funding some as they get into this budget. Have you seen any indication that that might happen?
I think that that's a strong likelihood. The governor indicated that in an interview yesterday with some reporters. In some ways, you know, it certainly gets a lot of people talking about the budget, but the legislature is going to take a look at this. Lawmakers may indeed put more school aid money back in the proposal. I think that already even some, you know, leading Republican senators have said, you know, this just doesn't give schools any extra money. And you do have to understand that the cost of living and inflationary costs and cost of health insurance go up every year. So for practical effect, I think it's a strong likelihood that legislators would try to find some way to give schools a little bit more money, but it's unclear how much. We just don't know that yet.
Well, turning to another item, this budget that's gotten some controversy, the idea of letting different people become teachers. Teachers without a certification could get certified to teach based on life experience and topic knowledge. How's that been received? Is it a potential money saver by widening the pool of potential teachers?
You've seen pretty strong feedback in opposition to this idea by teachers' unions and a lot of sort of traditional public school people, as well as the state superintendent, who says, you know, it's one thing to have general knowledge, but if you're just going to put a person in front of students with general knowledge who has no idea how to actually teach, how to teach kids with special learning needs, you know, how to manage a classroom. He says those are absolutely vital things that you need to have to be a certified teacher and to be able to deliver material in a way that's going to be effective for kids. The budget, as proposed, says that anyone with a bachelor's degree and enough street cred or life experience, if you will, could potentially become could get their license to be a teacher, a middle or a high school teacher, through some alternative pathway. It doesn't say who would be the person that would decide that you have enough life experience or that you'd be, you know, sort of a good pick for a teacher. But so far, we've seen pretty strong feedback against that idea from the teachers' unions.
And I'm guessing the phrase street cred doesn't appear verbatim in the budget.
It does not. That's sort of a practical interpretation.
Well, moving on to another one of the big things here. This is one we got a little preview of or a hint that it might happen. More opportunities to use public money toward attending private or religious charter schools, lifting that cap on the number of students under the state's voucher program. What kind of limitations are in place, though, now that that cap has been lifted?
Well, it hasn't been lifted yet. So the governor's budget obviously proposes that this new statewide program, the statewide voucher program, which was enacted about 2 years ago, currently allows 1,000 kids all around the state to attend a limited number of private, mostly religious schools. That was capped 2 years ago because you have to figure out how to fund kids who are going to attend a private school with public dollars. So starting that program small means that nobody was heavily affected financially, no school district anyway, was heavily affected financially by this very small program to start. The statewide program is limited by income, so you have to be a kid from a lower income family. But in the governor's budget proposal, that enrollment cap of 1,000 students would be removed entirely. So an unlimited number of kids in the state could attend a qualifying private religious school at taxpayer expense as long as that school met the qualifications to join the program. The problem is, if you're going to have a whole lot more kids go to private schools on public money, you have to figure out a way to pay for it. The governor's proposal says that each school district would have a portion of their state aid for each student redirected to follow that district student into a private school if that kid met the qualifications and could go to the private school on the voucher. The issue is, it's one thing for a student in, say, Wausau to be attending their public school and then, because they're income eligible, switch to attend a private school. So you redirect that state aid to the private school. But if you have a kid that's too young to attend school, say they're going to enter kindergarten, but they've never been educated in the Wausau district, that student is income eligible and decides to start using a voucher at a private school. Does Wausau have to cough up its state aid for a student that it never educated? And that's a question that we don't know yet. We don't have answers to that. That funding element yet.
And since the money in those original cases you said would follow the student in effect from the public school to the private school via that way of paying for the voucher, is there concern from among the public school community that in effect this is taking more money out of their budgets?
Absolutely. So anytime you create programs that divert students from public schools, you are by extension directing money away from public schools. And to a certain extent, you could argue that, well, if you're a district and you're no longer educating that student, you don't and shouldn't be getting public dollars for that student. On the other hand, public school districts say, listen, we have a lot of institutional built-in costs, special ed teachers, you know, resources for students that don't go away because five students left the district. We still provide those services. And so the way public schools have, you know, been designed is to have a large number of kids all, you know, sort of helping offset the costs of these sort of institutional costs. The more students you send away, the fewer students you have to pay for those resources in the public school systems. And that's what really concerns a lot of parents and teachers unions and teachers and school district leaders, that sort of thing.
We're talking with reporter Aaron Richards from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about the education policies and reforms in Governor Walker's state budget proposal.
And we'd like to hear from you on this. What is your reaction to some of these proposed changes to education? What do you think about the lack of spending increases for public education or expanding the state school voucher program? You can let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email us at talk@WPR.org.
We'll be back with Aaron Richards and take your calls after a look at the news with Kristen Durst. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're taking a closer look at the education proposals outlined in Governor Walker's biennial budget, and we're inviting your questions and your comments, too.
Do you agree with what you're hearing from the governor, including proposals to do away with Common Core standardized testing, grading school performances on an A through F scale? Call in 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. Aaron Richards is with us. She's an education reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Aaron, before we get to our callers, I wanted to get to that idea on Common Core standardized testing. As I understand it, kids are going to be taking this for the first time statewide this spring. Could be the last time, too, it sounds like.
Yeah, well, if according to the governor's budget, that would be correct. The state is rolling out a new test aligned to the Common Core standards. Testing starts soon, at the end of March. The governor's budget calls for tossing that exam entirely and also removing Wisconsin from a consortium, a national consortium of other states that are also using this particular assessment. There's another statewide, there's another test that's aligned to Common Core. It's part of a consortium that a group of other states are involved in. But Walker's budget calls for basically having Wisconsin get out of those national discussions. It's unclear yet what, if anything, would replace that test. There are some other options, but as the state superintendent, Tony Evers, has said, you know, it would cost quite a bit of money to start from scratch and figure out a new vendor, a new test, contract with somebody else, bring it in. So he's painting that idea as something that would cost even more than staying the course and figuring out how to use this new exam.
Let's go to our callers. We've got Nathan on the line in Milwaukee. Nathan, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to make two comments about public education. The first was dealing with training. And if we look at the public education system in Finland, one that's considered the best in the world, they actually have more extensive training than we have in the United States. So it appears that this would be going in the wrong direction. The other comment that I'd like to make is looking at the funding of charter schools. And when students go to charter school, the money is taken out of the public system. However, what hasn't been talked about is that if those students leave before the third Friday of the year, that money stays with the charter school, and if the student goes to a public school, that money doesn't follow them. Therefore, the money stays with the charter school, but not with the student who is getting public assistance.
Nathan, thanks for the call. I'm not sure if he means charters specifically or vouchers. Do you know how that works, Aaron?
A little bit. So there is a lot of debate about the movement of students between school sectors. There is an enrollment count taken by the state three times a year. The third Friday count is what we often focus on. That's the third Friday in September. There's also another enrollment count taken in January and then one taken near the end of the year. But it doesn't track individual students. So if a school has 300 kids in the fall of fall of September and then has 300 students in January, you don't know if those are the same 300 or if 10 left and 10 new ones came in. So that's one issue. There are a lot of complaints from, especially we see this in Milwaukee, because there's so much mobility between schools. You know, a lot of public school teachers say, you know, it seems like my classroom swells with students in January after kids have, you know, been in school for the fall. A voucher school would get that count and come back. But the data is hard to track, and I would say that a lot of times the voucher school and even charter schools, which are public, would say that, you know, we see just as much mobility as the public schools. We're getting kids in and out as well. So it's not just a flow in one direction. The state has tried to build in some safeguards for that to minimize one school being able to keep the dollars for a student for the entire year if they don't stay in the school, but it can get kind of tricky. There's, you know, it takes a bit of a lag time to figure out where the kids are and to potentially give someone a prorated amount for that kid for the year. So this is certainly probably one of the biggest issues in Milwaukee or any other high poverty district where kids are switching schools a lot.
Nathan, thanks for the call. We'll go to Amy in Lake Geneva now. Amy, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to call in and say that I do support Walker's expansion of the voucher program as a parent. My daughter was performing pretty high at her in her public school, and during one particular year, there was a student in there with a lot of serious behavioral problems, and she was helpful to that student, but unfortunately it came at a price to her own learning. I did notice that her MAP test score for math had gone down from winter to spring, and at that point I decided to pull her out and put her in a private school, and she's doing better, I believe, now.
Amy, thanks a lot for the call. And Aaron, that's the main argument advocates for school choice make for vouchers or charters, whatever alternatives, that maybe one size fits all at the public school doesn't work for every kid, so parents should have options like Amy had.
Exactly. That is part of the argument. You know, the idea that parents should choose the best school for their kids, where their child is going to thrive, and that the public money should follow that student. That's kind of the classic Milton Friedman idea of sort of choice in the marketplace. You know, Amy sounds like a savvy parent. I don't know if they're income eligible to receive a voucher, but that certainly could open up new opportunities for parents to actually obtain those public dollars so they wouldn't have to bear the entire cost of the tuition at the private school, you know, on their own. So, you know, I certainly there are lots of parents out there like Amy that are looking for those options.
Before we go back to the calls, and thanks, by the way, Amy, for that call, wanted to get into Governor Walker's entry into the school evaluation process. We've talked on this show with you, Aaron, about different school accountability proposals. What does the governor have to say in his budget?
He would like to change the way schools are ranked on their annual report cards from the way it is now, which is describing how well a school is meeting expectations or not on a variety of measures, from attainment on test scores to college readiness, attendance at the school. All those are factored in. But for the most part, they rely heavily on state test score results. He would like to change those, the way we grade those schools, to A through F letter grades, similar to what you would get in certain schools. That has been something that has been heavily opposed by many in the public school community because they feel like that is what they call politically charged ways of grading a school. You know, you may not be meeting expectations, but getting a D or an F, or seeing that your school has a D or an F, could, you know, be an unwarranted public relations headache. The governor also would like to see measures on the report cards that take better into account the way a school can help a child grow, meaning not, you know, physically, but if I am a low-income school in a challenged neighborhood, but I'm getting kids two or three grades behind in reading when they come to my school in first grade, but I'm able to really propel their growth to where by second or third grade they're almost on grade level, I should get extra credit for that, essentially. The governor has asked for that, and he is not, however, proposing sanctions for failing schools or schools that fail to meet expectations. That's something that's been a real hang-up in the legislature as lawmakers have tried to say, what should we do about school accountability? Is it enough to just tell people this is how your school scores, or do we need to take that second step that tries to remove or improve those consistently or chronically low-performing options?
Well, looking over all of this, as you pointed out, this is a budget proposal. It goes to the legislature next. Are we going to see a lot of movement, do you think, on some of these issues we've been talking about in one direction or another?
Oh, without a doubt. I don't think there's any, I think this is going to prompt a lot of debate. You're going to see a lot of, media is going to pick this apart. School districts and, lawmakers are going to pick this apart and try to find areas that they think are worth pursuing. At the same time, we're going to see a lot of bills introduced, I think, that may tackle this. So some of this is, well, a lot of this is going to be talked about going forward, and what actually makes it to law, you know, either whether it's passed in the budget or passed as separate legislation, we won't know that for months.
Yeah, the legislature had already worked some on school accountability outside of the budget. Is that one of those items that might be stripped out of the budget, tackled separately?
I think that's a possibility. Because we've already seen two competing bills in the Assembly and the Senate that deal with school accountability, it's a possibility, there could be, those could be worked out, and then that element would be removed from the budget entirely. So I think that this is more the governor trying to assert where he stands on these issues. It's certainly a blueprint for what he would like to see, and I think in some ways it's him trying to make a bold statement as he prepares to make what is almost widely understood as a presidential bid.
Aaron, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Aaron Richards, education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Governor Walker has called his budget the Freedom and Prosperity Proposal. Right now, we're going to take a look at the second part of that proposal, the prosperity part, in terms of economics.
UW-Madison applied economist Stephen Deller has joined us on occasion to talk about the role that state government can play in creating jobs, attracting businesses, and influencing wages.
Now, we're going to ask him to take a look at the Walker budget and explain the economic rationale behind some of the decisions and weigh in on whether or not he expects the desired results to be achieved. Stephen, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So we ended the last biennial budget with a surplus. Now we've got a deficit, and Governor Walker is proposing significant funding cuts to higher education, among other things. So why do we have a budget deficit?
Well, the reason we have one is because there was a forecast about a year ago that said that we might be looking at a surplus. The problem is that forecast was wrong. Essentially, the forecast was saying if Wisconsin recovers from the Great Recession at about the same rate as the U.S., then we would expect the surplus to be X amount of dollars. And the governor and the Assembly and the Senate essentially said, oh, surplus, tax cut. The forecast was wrong because the state's economy did not recover that quickly. It kind of lagged behind the national economy, and that surplus essentially did not exist. So that tax cut essentially drove a hole into the budget. Now, we think about the economy, and it raises the question of, if we did have a surplus, what should we do with it? And this is where you can get into different ideas about the economy. One ideas, well, you cut taxes. It's kind of the supply side economics perspective. And the thing is that the research is really clear. Supply side economics doesn't work. So that raises the second part of the question is, well, what if there was a surplus, what should we do with it? And this is where a lot of economists, some of my colleagues in the Department of Ag and Applied Economics, who are more on the conservative side than I might be, were saying, what we really should do is pay down some of the debt, pay off some of the credit card bills that we've run up. We should set some of the money aside so we can ride out ups and downs. And third, we should do some single, one-off infrastructure improvement projects. But we didn't do that. We went straight to a tax cut and got us into a big hole.
Well, now you mentioned the projected budget surplus, which didn't come to pass. But the rest of the country is seeing economic growth. The federal government has income rising or revenue rising. So why isn't Wisconsin following that same trend?
I think it's, again, as we've talked before, is the Wisconsin economy is just simply not keeping pace with the national economy and the states that are around us, particularly when you compare us to Minnesota. And we could spend the entire show talking about why Wisconsin is not doing as well as the other states.
Well, Governor Walker, to dig into the budget a bit more, he talked a lot about property taxes in that budget address, and he pointed out that property taxes stayed down. One of the things he pledged to do stayed down while he was in office. So what is the economic effect of lowering property taxes?
Well, there's a difference between lowering property taxes and actually just keeping them flat. One of the arguments that is made is that if you look at your property tax bill, it really didn't go down. Mine didn't go down. Mine stayed about the same. If it went down, it went down by a couple of bucks, which isn't enough to affect the economy. It's really kind of this general hatred of the property tax. I was involved with one study looking at how people viewed public education. It was not Wisconsin. It was another state. And people said, yes, we support public education. Would you be willing to pay higher income taxes? Yes, sure. Would you be willing to pay higher sales taxes? Yes, sure. Would you be willing to pay higher property taxes over my dead body? We almost have this irrational hatred of the property tax. So if the policy is that we want to keep downward pressure on the property tax, that's fine. But how are we going to make up for the differences? The other thing is that the vast majority of the property tax goes to fund local government services, primarily public schools. So when the governor is saying he's keeping downward pressure on property taxes, really what he's saying is that I'm keeping local governments kind of under my thumb.
Well, the median homeowner will apparently see $5 less in taxes annually. As you said, and Robin Voss said yesterday on the program, that it's essentially just keeping them flat if you account for various factors. But either way, you know, this is a modest number, $5 or keeping them flat. So does it have an impact if you look at the big picture?
No, it doesn't.
So it's how would you frame it then?
It's essentially again, this hatred of the property tax, and it was essentially a political promise to say, I'm going to keep downward pressure on this tax that people do not like. And he was able to deliver on that. But the question is then, at what cost is that promise going to play out in the long term?
Well, let's take another area here that's been a little contentious so far among Republicans. Governor Walker's proposed that the state borrow money through bonding to pay for a couple of items on the budget, notably transportation and the Milwaukee Bucks Stadium. And first of all, let's talk about that state bonding. How does that work?
Essentially, what we're doing is we're putting it on a credit card. And from a financial perspective, on the one hand, it makes sense to assume debt now because the interest rates are so low. But it's another one of those who are kicking the can down the road. Essentially, that's how we got into this mess in the first place, is that rather than dealing with the issues and addressing them honestly, we keep kind of saying, well, we'll put it on the credit card and we'll kick the can down the road a little bit. And that was one of the things that, you know, the governor was fairly successful when he was first elected. He said, no more kicking the can down the road. We cannot do that any longer. And that was like, good for him. That's good. That's the right thing to do. But now he's trying to kick the can down the road.
In terms of the funding itself, is it fair to say that this bonding is essentially public funding?
Well, it is, because the state is assuming the debt. The state has the responsibility for paying off the debt. And where is that going to come from? That's going to come from taxpayers.
So the alternative, I guess, to bonding would be raising taxes or making budget cuts somewhere else. So what do you think the rationale is for not doing that instead of borrowing money?
For not raising taxes?
For not raising taxes, not making more budget cuts. So why do the bond?
Because there is a big there's general agreement across the board, and we're having the same discussion at the federal level, is that our infrastructure funding is woefully inadequate. And it has been for years. And our infrastructure is not getting any better. It's deteriorating. The budget for it, or the funding for it, has been shrinking, and the demand for reinvestment has been growing, and that's creating a gap. We have to address that. It's important to the economy. It's important to our quality of life. The question is how do we address that? Well, one is we have to raise taxes. We have to take it from other sources. Education, perhaps, or we put it on the credit card. And what the governor is proposing is that we put it on the credit card.
Now, to take that metaphor of the credit card, you know, you or I get a credit card, it's going to have a max limit, and we can't go beyond that. Are there limits that the state has as well when it does bonding of this kind?
In theory, no. But in practicality, yes, because you have the things that the credit rating agencies that essentially determine how good of a risk or what is the credit worthiness of the state. The more that states assume debt and pay for more things through debt, their credit rating starts to take a hit. And what that means is that just like your own personal credit rating, if your credit rating is fairly high, bankers are willing to work with you. You may get a better interest rate. If your credit rating is low, bankers may not be willing to work with you. You'll have to pay a higher interest rate. So while there's no legal limit, there's a financial limit.
Well, we're talking right now to Applied Economics Professor Steve Deller from UW-Madison. He's giving us some input on the economic thinking behind the Walker budget and what the economic results could be for the state.
And you can join in the conversation now at 800-642-1234. Do you think that borrowing money through bonds for, say, transportation funding or supporting the Milwaukee Bucks arena are the right way to go? Do you think the focus on workforce training is needed in the state? That's what Governor Walker has called for in his budget proposal and elsewhere. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation after a look at the latest news with Kristen Durst.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation with Applied Economics Professor Steve Deller from UW-Madison. And we're talking about the economic thinking behind the Walker budget.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the economics behind the Walker budget? How do you think the slight property tax decrease or held flat, depending on who you talk to, will affect your family? Are you happy to see them at least stay where they are? Do you think the budget sets Wisconsin up for a good economic future? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Now, Steve, yesterday there was a bit of a dust-up when it was discovered that there was some editing done to some statutes involving the Wisconsin IDEA, and Governor Walker later said that removing the Wisconsin IDEA was a drafting error, and that got changed back, apparently. But the governor has said in the past that he thinks the university system should be more focused on preparing students for jobs that exist here in the state, and that implies a skills gap. So is there a skills gap in Wisconsin?
Well, let me talk about the Wisconsin IDEA. One of the things that makes Wisconsin so unique and so vibrant is that residents of the state view the university system as an asset, something that they can turn to. When a community is dealing with a problem, oftentimes first thing they do is they call the university for help. That's the Wisconsin idea. We have a lot of our neighboring states and a lot of states across the country that are actually public universities that are trying to embrace what we call the Wisconsin idea because they see the relevance of that. We have visitors from across the globe that are coming to Wisconsin to study the Wisconsin idea because they're seeing that that is really what higher education should be doing. So here, Wisconsin is at the forefront. Other states, other countries are trying to mimic what we're doing with the Wisconsin idea. And then here we are going the opposite direction. So it's really very, I'm glad that the governor has backed away from that. But I think it really gives the state a chance to kind of reflect on our priorities. Why do we invest in the university? The Wisconsin idea is a big part of that. Now, to your second question about workforce development, when I finished up my graduate work at the University of Illinois and was leaving, they had undertaken a major reflection on their undergraduate program. The concern was that they were becoming too technical oriented, too skills oriented. We're teaching technocrats. And the university was concerned about that. So they decided to do a self-reflection. They went around and they had a series of focus groups and discussions with a lot of the business community throughout Illinois. And they were shocked. The business community almost uniformly throughout Illinois said, no, we want the university to teach critical thinking skills, communication skills, leadership skills, teamworking environment skills. We want creative thinkers, leaders. That's what we want the university to do. We will teach them the technical skills that they need in the workplace. That really kind of was an eye-opener for the University of Illinois. So I think that the university's role really is much broader than simply training a student to become a better welder, if you will. That's not the role of the university.
And just briefly before we get to the calls we have, do you see this budget aspects of it as addressing the need to get workers into jobs here in Wisconsin?
I think the university's role is deeper than that. I think the university's role, besides the Wisconsin idea and besides an avenue to test new ideas, I think it's really to help the students and the residents of the state really be able to think a little bit more deeply about the issues that the state faces and the issues that individuals face, to be able to think critically, and to be a more engaged citizen. I think that that's the larger goal of the university. And purely technical skills, the university can play a role in teaching technical skills. I'm not saying that we should completely abandon that. I mean, we do a lot of training in terms of like engineering and accounting and things like that, and that's still very important, but that's not, I don't think that's the primary role of the university. The primary role of the university is to help people think a little bit deeper about issues.
Let's get to our callers. Jeff is joining us first in Wanakee. Hi, Jeff.
Good afternoon. I run a small bit, actually a number of small businesses over the years, and to me the most onerous thing is the sales tax, which merchants and service providers like myself do all the heavy lifting for and take all the heat about, and then these politicians go and spend that money like they did anything to create that fund. And it just boggles the mind that he acts like the property tax is the most crippling thing, and that's ridiculous. It would be, you know, our property tax lets a bunch of, you know, if he's going to reduce that, it lets all these out-of-state owners who contribute nothing to us and have the benefits of owning property here, and they get off scot-free. That's just utterly ridiculous to me. And secondly, I would like to say the UW system, and I'm a Whitewater graduate, very proud of it, the UW system, and through extension and even public radio, has been just a godsend in keeping me going and helping me keep abreast of things and give me the skills I need to compete and organize my business properly. And he not only doesn't seem to understand that, he doesn't value it whatsoever. He does not seem to be a real world business person.
Jeff, I'm going to let our guest get in on that. Thank you for your comment. Appreciate that. And Steve, what about looking at sales tax?
The sales tax, there's a couple of different things the way economy. Well, first of all, I want to say my wife teaches at UW-Whitewater, so I'm a little connection there. I think that there's a couple of different ways you want to look at taxes. What makes for a good tax? What makes for a bad tax? One of the things that we want to look at is the ability to administer the tax. And I think that that's what Jeff is getting to, is to essentially, you know, how onerous is that tax on the people that have to administer it? You know, the sales tax, you know, can be, the way it's structured, can be onerous, but it's generally considered one of the least onerous taxes to impose. But I think we've talked before about the role of kind of small businesses in the state, and I think that the backbone of the state's economy and the future of the state's economy is really in small business development. And here the university and the technical schools can play a very supporting role in helping small businesses. And I'm not sure that the economic development policies that are coming out of the governor's office are really thinking small businesses. I think they're still kind of in that we want to hit a home run. We want to get that big firm to move in.
Okay, well, thanks a lot for the call, Jeff. And let's move on for a moment to education. In the governor's budget, lifting the cap on voucher schools, allowing the money from a public school student to follow that student should they transfer to a private school, to a voucher school. Can you explain some of the economics behind that?
The idea basically, it's coming down to choice, is that we want to try to provide parents and their children the choice of schools to go to. And for higher-income communities, oftentimes there's private schools and there's opportunities there. And I think what the governor's trying to do with this is to provide people with a choice. The question is this an effective policy? What kind of standards do we hold these charter schools to? Are we holding them to any standards? Second, is the research suggesting that students that go to these charter schools do any better? And the evidence is saying it doesn't. The third problem is that once you get outside of metropolitan areas, you get into rural areas, you don't have the critical mass for these charter schools to really function. So it's really kind of an urban-focused policy. You get into rural Wisconsin, and it's a non-starter.
And what about the impact on public schools? How do you see that being a burden on public schools, or do you see it as something, Robin Voss was optimistic about that yesterday on the program about the economics. He didn't see a big burden being placed on public schools or on public schools taking a big hit from this. What do you see from an economics perspective?
Well, it's the problem with it is that there's still a fixed cost to running a school. You still have to, whether you have 20 students in the classroom or 25 students in the classroom, you still have the cost of the student or the teacher. You still have the cost of turning the lights on. You still have the cost of maintaining the building. So in that regard, what's happening is that the public school system still has the same level of cost, but it's chipping away at the ability to pay that. And that's where the state has to set a priority. It has to essentially say, what is our top priority and how are we going to go with that?
Stephen, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with Applied Economics Professor Stephen Deller of UW-Madison about the economics of Governor Walker's budget.